Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good evening. Time for another conversation. I'm Robin Williams, and my guest tonight has occupied the bestseller list in your papers for months and months, which is a bit of a surprise as her book is demanding. It races around the centuries and the globe and is stuffed with science, which she gets right. And her hero, or heroine if you like, is a book, a codex. Geraldine Brooks has talked about the story of the Haggadah in various programs, but I wanted to talk to her about the technicalities, because they're so fascinating, like the forensics in a murder mystery. How do you tell from molecules and dead fragments in a codex what the people were like who once owned it or looked after it? A codex, by the way, is an assembled set of parchments bound into a book. Once there were only loose pages. Books came much later. Like the Book of Kells, sitting in the great glorious library at Trinity College in Dublin. Geraldine, have you ever seen it?
I haven't seen the Book of Kells. I've only seen a facsimile of it.
What did you think of it?
It's beautiful. It's a little more understated than other illuminated manuscripts, and I respect that. I think there's a lot of restraint in the use of colour, which when you think about the times that these books were created, having access to those bright pigments must have been so wonderful and stimulating and just, you know, blast the top of your head off, because we live in a world saturated with visual inputs. But people in the Middle Ages didn't. So these must have been even more extraordinary then.
Well, one of the reasons I mentioned the Book of Kells is the exhibition there in Dublin on Trinity College campus and that amazing library, which is so long and itself a work of art, actually has the minerals and the pigments all displayed. Lapis lazuli, for example, coming from the other side of the planet, even in those days. You know, how much were you aware of those sorts of stories, of the rarity and the distance carried for these materials?
When I started researching the book, not at all, but it was one of the avenues of research that really gripped me, because lapis lazuli and the colour it makes is ultramarine, ultra beyond marine the sea, which was how people described this mineral that they were making the pigment from, because it came from beyond the sea, meaning Afghanistan. And you imagine these beautiful blue stones being loaded into camel bags and trekked over high mountain passes and then making sea voyages. And it's quite remarkable. And all of the colors, you know, have a story. So vermilion comes from little insects, tree-dwelling insects that you crush up and you get this rich red color. So vermiculum means little worm in Latin, and that's how we still call it vermilion today. But my absolute favorite pigment is Indian yellow, which you get from the piss of cows that have been fed only on mango leaves.
I was going to ask you about that. It seems, how did they think of it in the first place to feed mango leaves to cows?
I guess one day they had a lot of mango leaves and somebody said, gee, that piss is an interesting colour, and they went from there.
They put it onto the parchment. You know, because what you're looking at is the skin of an animal. That's really the material that they use. So you take the piss of a cow and put it on the skin of an animal.
I think you had to dry the piss.
Yeah, you did.
And possibly boil it for a long time to get that colour. But I encountered all these colours. There's a fantastic place called the Strauss Center for Conservation, and it's attached to the Fogg Museum at Harvard. And when you climb up from the museum, which is a beautiful art museum, up the stairs to the conservation center, the entire stairwell is lined with little vials, and in them are all these wonderful old pigments, and they were collected by Mr. Strauss, who a century and a half ago decided it was his mission to collect a sample of every single colour that had ever been produced by human hands. And so there they are, the Strauss collection, lining the walls, and it's like walking inside a rainbow. It's fantastic.
But you went there and you saw a conservator actually working on the book.
I had an email relationship with the chief conservation scientist over there, and he was extremely helpful, and his name was Narayan Kandahar. And I wanted to write about how a conservator would investigate a wine stain on a piece of old parchment. And I was particularly interested in kosher wine and if there was any difference between kosher wine and non-kosher wine. So he emailed me and said, could you, you know, pick up a bottle of each, come over, I've got some old, very old parchment scraps here and we'll splash it around and see what happens. So I arrived with my two bottles of wine and I was very pleased when Narayan Kandahar met me at the desk and said, g'day, mate, because he's a bloke from Melbourne.
Oh, so. You're kidding.
And seeing I was making my conservator an Australian, that helped me feel that my character's career path was more plausible.
Yes, indeed. So you had the kosher wine. Did it make any difference from ordinary wine?
To tell you the honest truth, not detectable. However, there is a chemical difference, and I decided to use that fact because when you make kosher wine, you make it differently in that you don't use any animal product whatsoever, whereas in traditional winemaking, you would use egg white to clarify the wine at some stage in production. And in kosher wine, they substitute a kind of a very fine, almost an earth that does the same job without leaving any animal residue. So in theory, there would be a protein detectable in a kosher wine stain. However, in fact, because the parchment itself is protein, it's sort of too loud. You can't pick up the signal.
Yes, and was there really blood there along with the wine?
So I said to Narayan, I really want to see what would happen with the blood stain. And he said, well, where are we going to get any blood? And I said, well, give me that scalpel you've got over there. I whacked it into a finger. And that you can see that it makes a harder edge stain than the wine. The wine is more.
There's commitment to your art. That is amazing. Well, many people will have read the book and many people will have heard you talk about some of the plot, so I don't want to give too much away in that regard. But a particular scene where you have wine and blood is a wrenching one because you're talking about the Inquisition and you're talking about some way of defending what is in fact a Jewish work of art from a Catholic priest who can almost at a whim condemn it to oblivion.
There was a long index of perceived heresies that the censors of Hebrew and Islamic texts would read the books looking for these heresies, and they were pretty easy to find if you wanted to find one. Anything against the Catholic Church was construed as, if you said anything about idolaters, then the censor could construe that you're using that as a veiled reference to Catholicism, and bang, into the fire goes the book.
But in this case, it wasn't what was written, it was what was in the picture.
Well, this is where the novelist's invention comes in. But the illuminations of the book that inspired my novel, The Sarajevo Haggadah, have a lot of unusual elements to them. And this is a very, very early manuscript. And when the artist is depicting the creation of the world, the division of the dark from the light and the water from the land, it's a lovely series of miniature paintings. And in each of them, the earth is shown as round. And also the sun and the moon are placed so that you could possibly construe it that the earth is rotating around them, which, of course, was the heliocentric heresy. So I've played with that a little bit as the priest is examining the book.
So it wasn't really there. Are those pictures there? Actually?
They are. Those, like that.
I mean, 600-700 years ago.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, definitely the earth is shown as round, which was still a minority view at that time.
That's quite surprising, isn't it?
So we don't know who that artist was, and oh boy, would I love to know.
Yes, yes. So have you any idea how it was that the book came to be spared? Because you actually have the writing of that priest.
Yes, he did write, surveyed by me, and that was the indicator that there was nothing against the church in it. And I think it was spared because the story of Passover, which is what the book relates, is pretty much taken straight from the Bible. So there's not a great deal of room for interpretation. So probably, you know, an honest reading of the text led him to the belief that this book was okay to go. They were much more concerned about the Talmud and all the arguing and back and forth that goes on in the Gemara and the commentaries, and a lot of Talmuds went to the flames.
Oh, yes, indeed, hundreds of them.
Thousands, maybe even, yeah.
Were they moved, these inquisitors, by the sheer beauty, or did they find that an extra incentive to wipe the stuff out?
I think you can imagine that they had both views. You can make, when you're trying to think your head into a character and create a character, I thought, well, perhaps if somebody is antipathetic to the Jewish faith and they see a beautiful book like this, they think, how seductive, we better get rid of it in case it misleads somebody away from the true path. Or because these had to be extremely learned men to have mastery of these languages, perhaps they were dazzled by the beauty and tried to find ways to protect it.
What's behind the fact that the Jewish artists made it in the first place? Because it was supposed to be against even their code of conduct.
Very, very few medieval Jewish books have illustrations of any kind because of the commandment, thou shalt not make any graven image or likeness of anything. So to find this book full of wonderful pictures made it an extraordinary rarity and actually caused art historians to reassess that view that figurative art had been suppressed among medieval Jews. And once they went back and looked, they found that there was more of it than they thought. But we don't know why this book was made that way. A Haggadah is used in the home. It's not a synagogue book in any way. So it was a family's prized possession. And my hypothesis is that because it was made in Spain at a time when there was a great deal of intellectual exchange between Christians and Muslims and Jews, that time known as convivencia, that a Jewish family who was very prosperous, they had to be to afford a book illuminated with so much gold leaf and lapis and what have you, I had seen a Christian prayer book and been blown away by it. And because the Passover is the festival where you're supposed to teach your children the traditions and the stories of the Jews being freed from slavery, what better way to teach children than with a beautiful picture book?
Sure. And did it really have silver clasps?
No, I'm afraid I made that up. Probably a book like this would have originally had a beautiful binding. And books of similar quality that I've seen had fantastic bindings made of mother of pearl shell or inlaid leather and gold tooling and you name it, very lovely. And usually a parchment book would have clasps to keep the pages flat. And so we don't know what the original binding was, because by the time it turned up in the 1890s in Sarajevo, it had been rebound. And then it was rebound again, I'm afraid, very clumsily in Vienna. And a very third-rate cardboard cover was put on it and the parchments were cropped, which is a horror to book conservators because you don't know what might have been trapped there in the binding.
Yes, that's an earlier chapter. Very interesting. Now, some of the material that you find on the pages, some of it you again made up. What about the wing, the insect's wing?
Yes, well, I knew that I wanted to tell the story of this codex that had been created sometime in the 1300s and still existed, and I wasn't sure how I was going to bind together 500-600 years of stories. And that's when I had the lucky break of finding out that an actual conservator had been hired to work on the book. And so I was able to sit and observe her work. And I had no idea that conservators are in part detectives. And watching how she approached this book, she was doing work on, you know, restitching it and things that you would expect. But if she found anything, it was very exciting, and she'd get out her long tweezers and she'd take it and carefully set it aside for chemical analysis. One thing she found she was hoping would be a breadcrumb or a matzah crumb, and this little speck of smuts, you know, that was put away and, you know, was going to be chemically analyzed, because she said if it's bread or wheat product, you might be able to tell what kind of wheat and that might tell you where it was. So that gave me the idea of how I was going to bind my story together by having a conservator find these things. And The insect wing came. I was lucky enough to have a fellowship at Harvard for a year, and it was an interdisciplinary program where you got to sit and listen to other people talk about their work in diverse fields. And I was listening to Naomi Pierce, who is a very distinguished evolutionary biologist. And she was talking about blue butterflies in northern Queensland and how they have squads of attendant ants who keep them safe when they're in their caterpillar stage and are rewarded by a tasty secretion that the caterpillars give. And I'm sitting there and it's not directly relevant to my book. And then suddenly I had this idea, what if my conservator found a bit of a butterfly that only exists in the Alps at high altitude? And so I went over with Naomi Pierce to the absolutely fabulous Natural History Museum at Harvard, where she has a very sophisticated evolutionary biological lab tucked away behind all the cabinets of curiosities. And we went down to the collections room and we looked at butterflies and we figured out that the Parnassus was my guy, that they only exist over several thousand feet. And she also showed me Nabokov's butterflies because he had been in charge of that collection. And so there's a whole cabinet of the butterflies labelled in his handwriting.
Vladimir Nabokov, the author, the novelist, Lolita and so forth, was one of the really great butterfly experts in the world. In fact, you know, he was a learned professor. The collection is there, is it?
It is. And it's a most remarkable place, the Natural History Museum, because it has Thoreau's tortoise, you know, that he collected and labelled, and it has all kinds of parasites extracted from the guts of the great and good of Boston of the 18th century. So, I mean, it's just fabulous. And then you go into Naomi Pierce's DNA extraction lab and it's all, you know, incredibly spiffy and, you know, forward-leaning.
Geraldine Brooks, I associate you with other authors such as Ian McEwan and Peter Carey.
Very nice company.
Well, they write beautifully and they take on really complex ideas, but they love science and they incorporate science so effectively into their work. And Margaret Atwood, you know, just to pick another name such an eminent collection. And the trouble is that if you have something technical in your work, you're exposing yourself possibly to people saying, you got that wrong, or some sort of nitpicker who doesn't quite see that you're using it in a creative sense. How much of that has come so far since the publication of the book of people going, nah, that's not quite right?
Fortunately, not a lot just yet. Nobody's called me on being able to detect the protein, but because this is pretty specialized stuff. But,
indeed,
you know, you have a wonderful get-out-of-jail-free card as a novelist.
Of course, yes.
Where you can say, I knew that, but I chose to go a different direction.
But it really does give a tremendous amount of substance to the writing. It really, you've got stuff you can chew on there, including the brain surgery.
Well, I loved science when I was a child. I was going to be a scientist. I had a lab set up in the back veranda of our suburban house in Concord in Sydney, and I love to blow up my test tubes. I did things that you would never be able to do now. I got a chemistry set for my son, and it was so disappointingly bland, you know. They had goggles and gloves and all these things that I never bothered with, shards of glass flying everywhere. But, you know, so in a way, being a novelist is a license to return to all these passions of one's childhood, and you can call up and bother people. And actually, the wonderful thing about scientists in general is that they love to talk about their work and share their passions. Yeah.
Now, your characters come from different eras. Each of the chapters, as you go to and from Dr. Heath, who's really carrying us through the Haggadah, trying to work out really some of its story. Nonetheless, you've got chapters which go back to hundreds of years ago or tens of years ago. And we meet different people doing different things, which is part of the enjoyment. What did your husband say about that aspect of the book?
Well, when he read the first complete draft of the book, he looked up at me and he gave a long sigh and he said, a lot of characters, a lot of different time periods. I don't know, Bubby, he said, this is an inspired mess.
Well, it's clearly the readers haven't taken it like that. They relish.
I've been throwing this back at him and saying, you know, that just shows that you're a very impatient, block-headed reader.
That's right. But the main point, I mean, you've got here some of the worst aspects of human beings. They do appalling things to each other. It really is a shocking thing to read. And yet, on the other hand, you've got such wonderful acts like the saving of the book by Muslims twice. And I'll come to that in a minute, the picture we've got of humanity. But one of the main points that came out of the book for me, as it must for many others, is how important it is to have this cultural history. It's 5 years after the trashing of the Baghdad Museum, where yet again people's heritage was trampled. How much was that part of the story that you wanted to focus on?
Because I was in Sarajevo during the siege, and I had the absolutely, you know, heart-sickening experience of walking over the ashes of the burned books of the National Library of Bosnia, which was deliberately shelled with phosphorus bombs, because that war in Bosnia was a war against civilians, but it was also a war against an idea, which was that civilians like these in Sarajevo, where people of different ethnicities and religions had lived and created together for centuries, that was anathema to the ethnic cleansing extremists. And so if you want to destroy that society, you also want to destroy a record that such a place could exist and function. So that's why you target the Oriental Institute, which had manuscripts in Turkish and Arabic and going back many, many centuries, almost entirely destroyed. 90% of the collection of the Bosnian National Library destroyed. And many of those manuscripts had yet to be studied by modern means, lost now. Knowledge of who we are as a species, how we came to be the way we are, all gone.
Well, of course, Richard Dawkins wrote a book called The Extended Phenotype, suggesting that we evolve, not so much because our bodies evolve these days, but because our culture does. And that's what's all around us, you know, the machines, the books, the artworks, everything, the music. It's all us. And when you are looking at, on the one hand, kindness and heroism, and on the other, that sort of bastardry, it's as if your book is about who's going to win in the end.
I think none of us win when these massive acts of vandalism happen. I think there are always people who can see through these vicious shifts when we're encouraged to hate otherness. And so I think what is inspiring is that there always are people who have the guts to say no to it and who, you know, really put themselves on the line. In the history of this little book, The Sarajevo Haggada, that was so inspiring to me, we know that it was saved twice by Muslim hands, once by a Catholic priest, but there must have been many other saviors going back to the time of the Spanish Inquisition and the expulsion of the Jews and Muslims from Spanish territory. So we don't know who those unsung cultural heroes were, but it was fun to try and imagine them.
Yes, there are heroes among all the villains. People of the Book by Australian author Geraldine Brooks is a thumping bestseller here and has been for months. She's now living in America. And I see that Ian McEwan's latest is based on climate change, so science still underpins quite a few current top-selling novelists' work. Not surprising, really. Next week, we shall be in conversation with another exuberant author, this time a really qualified scientist-come-journalist, Oliver Morton, whose latest book is called Eating the Sun. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.